Good morning.
Good
morning, everybody. You are in the Los Angeles room in Los Angeles, next door to Los Angeles International Airport, where a panel will be held, it says in a few minutes, where we're going to start. Before we begin, will you please take a moment and silence all of your electronic devices? Thank you. Welcome to the 54th birthday party of Overeaters Anonymous. My name is Aaron. I am a compulsive overeater and your moderator for this panel.
Hi,
everybody. Once again, if you haven't done so already, please silence all electronic devices. And would all who care to please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I will not mind be done. Amen. In keeping with the birthday party theme of higher power, the topic of this panel is Where Are You, God? Finding Power in the Midst of Relapse. Our speakers today are Sarah P., Kate R., and Rosemary. Each will share their experience, strength, and hope for 15 minutes. After the speakers have shared, we will have 20 minutes for questions. A basket will circulate around the room while the speakers are sharing. If you wish to ask a question, write it down and drop it in the basket. We will do our best to get through as many questions as possible. If you would like to direct your question to a specific speaker, please write their name along with your question. You will find paper and pencils in the basket that is being circulated. And our first speaker this morning is Sarah P. from Los Angeles.
Good morning. My name is Sarah P. I'm a compulsive overeater. I'm just going to qualify briefly. I came into Overeaters Anonymous in 1994 and have had three major relapses in that period of time. My first relapse, I gained 60 pounds. My second relapse, I gained 80 pounds. And my third relapse, I gained 124 pounds. And so I really believe that I don't have the ability to come back from another relapse. I think this is life and death for me. I have, my abstinence date is 8-6-12. Is that right? I have over a year of abstinence. And I'm down 91 pounds in that period of time. I want to talk briefly about what happens right before a relapse for me, and I'm just going to read from the big book because without this book I would be totally lost. It says the alcoholic may say to himself in the most casual way, "It won't burn me this time, so here's how." Perhaps he doesn't think at all. How often have some of us begun to drink in this nonchalant way, and after the third or fourth, pounded on the bar and said to ourselves, "For God's sakes, how did I get started again?" And then I wrote on the side, this was back in 1999, I wrote sugar-free cookies on the side of this, because that relapse had started with these lemon sugar-free cookies, which somehow I convinced myself that because I don't eat sugar, that was okay. And that was my gateway into the next day, which was a lemon bar. And then the next day was ice cream for breakfast, and you know, and it goes on and on and on. How did I get started each time? You know, I had abstinence under my belt, and yet I made the decision to go out and eat again. And now I've always been told that my relapse started long before the first bite. And so at some point I must have stopped believing in a power greater than myself. I remember one time in one of my relapses that I really thought that this was a diet and calorie club. I had lost, when the weight came off, the necessity to do the work, the daily work that it took to keep relapse at bay, it wasn't so important anymore. I was hip, slick, and cool. I was going out. I was flirting with disaster. And the meetings got less, calls to the sponsor fewer and farther in between, and then there was a lemon cookie, right? I mean, a sugar-free lemon cookie right in front of me, and I thought, it's not going to burn me this time. So I'm going to talk about briefly this last relapse that I was in. And I said to my sponsor this morning, I didn't have any power in my relapse. How did I mean, I don't understand the title of this. Where was the power in my relapse? And so she had me look back and think. And what I came up with was I was going to diet doctors and surgeons and clinics in my relapse with a head full of program. I knew where my solution was. I knew my solution was in these rooms. I knew my solution was in the literature. But yet I was looking for outside help. And what happened was it wasn't working. I had gone to a surgeon about a gastric bypass. I was 125 pounds up, and I thought my solution was getting my stomach stapled. And I went in for the consultation, and I was declined because I needed a pacemaker. He said I needed a pacemaker. I had to go to a heart surgeon. I couldn't control. I was having heart problems because I was obese, and I was eating. No, I was just eating all day long. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't go. I couldn't walk into the cardiologist's office without having somebody from program know what I was doing. And so I called a girlfriend who was no longer in the rooms, but she was connected to people in the rooms. And she took me to the Sunday Morning Big Book in Santa Monica, California. And I sat in the back, and I think I was late. And I raised my hand, and I said that I was completely powerless over food. And that's when it came. That's when God showed up. Or that's when I could see him. That's when I could see God. I just had to admit that I was powerless, and I had nowhere else to go. For me, this is the last house on the block. There's no magic solution. There's no magic pill. This is the last house on the block for me. And so in that moment of admitting I couldn't do it anymore, I got relief. I think that was the first day that I stopped eating ice cream for breakfast. I'd wake up and eat. I would go right at it with the ice cream. But so I got a sponsor the next within that month. And life has changed. I hadn't worked in 4 years when I came back. You know, my relapse was really self-centered. I couldn't work. I didn't want to work. So things have changed since then. I've since held down a job for the last year. I've become a productive member of my relationship, of my fellowship, of my community. And it's because I just did that one thing, which admitted that I couldn't do this by myself anymore. The first word in the big book is we. We. I have no, on my own, I have no defense against the first bite. And I just want to say how powerful this this birthday party is for me. I came last year. I was comped a ticket because I hadn't been working and I couldn't afford a ticket on my own. And I went to as much, I just absorbed it as much as I could. I was freshly abstinent. I went to the big book study, and I just, it just really was a pivotal moment in the beginning of my recovery to come and just soak all this up. And I'm so grateful to be here. And just as a side note, Kate and I, who's also on the panel, she was a member of my God Squad back before 9/11 and in before my second relapse. And so to come here and see somebody that I haven't seen for years is such an act of God for me. You know, God shows me miracles every day. But the fact that I could come back from another relapse with his help and your help, and to be witness to the miracles is really amazing. How much time do I have?
About 6 minutes.
Boy, what am I going to say for 6 minutes? It's going to make some... That's really hard. So, relapse. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory and the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink and without defense against the first bite. I am without defense. An oatmeal cookie is this far away. And for those who are listening, it's the length of my arm. You know, it's... As far as I can reach, there's a relapse there. But between me and my hand, I really believe it's God. This whole stretch of space right here is God. And I don't have anything without that. Thank you. So I don't know. I'm not gonna fill any more time. I don't know what else to say except for that was my solution. It is my solution on a daily basis. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Sarah. And our next speaker is Kate R. from Los Angeles.
Hi, I'm Kate, compulsive overeater.
Hi.
I'm really excited to be here. I haven't been to a birthday party in probably 8 years. Thank you, Sarah. It's so amazing. I saw her in the hall, and I was just so excited to see her. And then I come in the room, and I see her name, and it's like, it's amazing because I came into the rooms in 1999. I was 23. I was in grad school. And I was getting up at 5 a.m. every morning to run. And if I didn't get up, then it was like, you know, the day was over. As far, you know, I would wear my workout clothes all day long just in case I could get that workout in. And then I would go and, like, sit around and procrastinate all day and then stay up all night and binge on diet food and study and then miss my class the next morning, you know, because I'd stayed up all night binging on diet food. And I remember driving, I'm a little nervous, driving to the market for diet things and just like not having, like, what was it you just read, the sufficient force? I fail to remember with sufficient force. It's like I knew that it wasn't a good idea, but I had no power to stop driving to the store. And so I came to OA. My roommate, Eskimo, was sober and in Al-Anon, and she told me about these rooms. And so I started coming, and I just hit the ground running. And I thought I had found the way to be perfect. I thought, finally, there are rules. And they even say rules for living, you know. It's like, great, I'm really good at rules. I'm really good at rules. And so I was just like, okay, I'm going to do everything everyone says. I'm going to go to a meeting a day for like 3 years. I'm going to, I mean, and I was just Little Miss OA in my head. I mean, I'm sure, yeah, none of you guys thought of me as Little Miss OA, so, but I really thought I was, and I was with the service commitments and the sponsees and the quoting the big book, like, and there's times when it's like a pissing contest, you know, with the big book where people are just like, I can, you know, just, and I was like that. I was so, bless my heart, just so wanting to be perfect. And I did that for about 7 years. And I got skinnier. My top weight—I never really loved weighing myself, so I don't know exactly what my top weight was, but it was somewhere around 200 pounds. And I got down to a size 8, size 10, size 8, and I'm about a 10 or a 12 right now. And I thought every time I had a feeling, I would just cut out another food, because those feelings, there must be something wrong. If I'm having a feeling, I must have done something wrong. So how about let's not eat X or let's not eat Y, you know? And it got to the point where I was going to school and I'd take my lunch, I would take all my meals, because if you fail to plan, if you plan to fail or whatever, you know, like and it would be like a hard-boiled egg and celery, and that would be my lunch. And I just thought I was great. I thought everything was great. I was skinnier. I was getting attention. I was dispensing advice to anyone within, like, you know, whatever arm's length. And I graduated from school. I started working more regularly. I started working in my dream job. And I met a man. Can you tell where this is going? Well, actually, a few things happened. I moved from Santa Monica, from Brentwood, which is in West Los Angeles. There's very there's strong recovery all over the Los Angeles area, for those who aren't from this area, but there's like a special brand on the west side, and I moved to the Valley, and there's a different brand in the Valley, and I went to these meetings, and I didn't have my God squad. In fact, my sponsor, she betrayed me by getting plastic surgery, and my God squad were all relapsing, and I was just like, well, I have, it's her fault. It's all her fault. No, I was so bewildered. I'm like, but we're following the rules. We're all following the rules. And I have to say, I really, really get principles before personalities now, in a way that I didn't. And the spiritual foundation of our program being anonymity, that it's not about, I mean, as a fellowship, it's such an incredible force of my higher power to have all of you in my life, but you are not going to keep me abstinent. And so I went to the Valley meetings and I felt it's such a fraud. And I would raise my hand and I would share, you know, the word. And because I knew it, and I was just, but I was dying inside, and I couldn't control the food the way I'd been controlling it. That's one thing that happens is, and Sarah mentioned also, like, you start to, my body changed, my life got bigger, and I started to think that it was me who was doing it. Like, I thought it was because I was going to the meeting every day, calling my sponsor at this time, reading this many pages of the big book, like, you know, basically, like, if I just turn around 3 times and, you know, click my heels together, it means I get to stay abstinent. And I didn't have room for being human and actually being powerless over food. You know, like, somehow I thought by doing those things, I had gained power over food. And so, bless my heart. So in that 3 years that I was out of the rooms, I grew to hate OA. I hated it. I hated the jargon. I hated the acting as if. I felt like everybody has food problems. What, you know, why do I need to have a disorder? Like, you know, everybody binges from time to time, you know. And never mind that I was in a relationship that I'd made this man, poor guy, did not sign up to be my higher power, but I made him my higher power. And it was awful. He was not good at that, being my higher power. And And I would basically sit and just eat and eat and eat, and I would drink wine and eat and eat and drink and eat and drink and wait for him to be the man that I wanted him to be. And that I thought, you know, if he loved me, then I would be enough and I wouldn't need God. And somehow, I read a book, if you're interested in what it was, ask me after. But it was written by one of our members. And it just reminded me of this fellowship and reminded me of, like, the desperation. Before I read that book, I actually went on a real bona fide diet. I paid for it, and like I went in and got measured and weighed in and all this stuff, and I did it perfectly, and I showed up to those little meetings and would like try to talk about my feelings, and these poor women in the diet room were just like, you know, they were just had no idea what I was talking about, and I was just like, so, you know, and after that diet, because I did it perfectly, and I wrote down everything, and the book was, like, you know, crusted over with, like, because I was making my dinners looking at it, and just, as soon, the day that diet was over, I was, like, on the pastry case, you know, with my nose up against it, just, it's like, I couldn't wait to have the foods that I wasn't allowed to have, and so, I read that book, I went to jury duty. I brought pastries to jury duty. We were trying to deliberate over whether or not a man had committed murder. And all I could think about was the pastries. And I thought, I just read this book. I thought, that doesn't seem normal. You know, like, I'd really like to be the kind of person who could bring her full self to this huge decision. And also there's something, anyway, I won't get into that. But and I just felt an ache for this fellowship, and I was compelled back into the rooms. And then, like, I think 2 weeks later, my boyfriend broke up with me, and it was like I didn't have any friends, because when I had dived into that relationship, I just, anybody who kind of challenged what he and I had, just no more. And so I kind of came up from the fog, and like I didn't see anyone. And so thank God I went to the rooms, because I just went to a meeting, like, you guys all got to hear about my breakup for, like, a good year. There's people who are at my first meeting back, which was about five plus years ago, who are just look at me, and they're like, yeah, I heard about him for a long time. So I'm stubborn. And, you know, our literature talks about repurposing our character defects as character assets. And I think it even says stubbornness can be tenacity. So I stubbornly did it differently. I knew that my nature was to try to be perfect and to try to be better. Really, being perfect would be to be better than you and to have all the answers. And so I went in to my meetings. I went to one a week, maybe. I didn't get a sponsor right away. Like, I just did everything opposite. And I have a sponsor now. I go to meetings, and I have sponsees, and I do service. But it's all come about from a real desire. There's a line of an honest desire to have God lead me to better things. And I have the honest desire to have God lead me to better things. And I shared wherever I was at, even if it was ugly, angry. I've heard people say 2 minutes, 1 minute on the problem, 2 minutes on the solution. I abandoned that, because acting as if had pushed me into my will. And now I have a different understanding of acting as if, where it really is a leap of faith, you know, but for a while, acting as if with, I'll just do it, because, and then it's like there's no room for my higher power in it. So I guess I also have a different understanding of powerlessness and a different understanding of surrender this time around. Like, I realize that I am a compulsive overeater. When life gets big, scary, confusing, frustrating, I either want to eat or control my food and body. And that's who I am. That's what I do. That is never going to change. Like, I want to go on a diet because I got called for the scary job, you know? That's my abnormal reaction. And so rather than think, oh, my God, I did something wrong, my recovery sucks because I had that thought, my recovery today is I had that thought and I can turn my will and my life over 1 minute at a time to my higher power, who I don't understand. I really don't understand God. And that's okay, too, because I want my God to be beyond comprehension. I want my higher power to, if I can conceive of him, then he's of my making. And so I've come to see surrender as a gift, not something I can will. And that's really disappointing sometimes because, you know, I have the desire, but that doesn't always mean that I've got the surrender. And I also am very, very slowly coming to accept, thank you, that even when times are hard, when I'm feeling depressed or frustrated or scared or angry, when I'm having feelings, it's not just like, let's work the steps harder and I won't feel that way anymore. I do work the steps. I love the steps. I'm on step 11 right now, on the cusp of step 12. I work the steps with my sponsees, and they are my spiritual path. And I think that part of my spiritual path is also having all of the big uncomfortable feelings that I used to eat over. And I am learning how to not replace that eating with controlling, kind of. So, ideally. So, it's interesting being here. I just have a couple seconds left. I'm just really grateful to be here and humbled to be here. I'm really amazed by the capacity of this program. And I think that's all I have to say. Thanks.
Thank you, Kate. Please keep the basket of questions going around as we continue on. You asked me to remind people that. And our next speaker is, our last speaker is Rosemary from Oceanside, New York.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. I'm Rosemary, and I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Rosemary.
When I came into program, my hair was the same color as Kate's. It was 1986. My recovery had begun before that. In 1977, I put the cork in the bottle, and I stopped drinking because I couldn't drink without drinking to excess. But I never found it into the rooms. And, okay, thanks. And then it took me 10 years. 1986 is when I found my way into the rooms. But during that 10-year period, I had begun therapy. A woman, a mentor who I had worked with, had said to me, and I loved her very much, and I knew that she loved me. She said to me, did you ever think about therapy? And I was able to hear it. And I did find my way to a therapist who was a tremendous gift in my life. She began my recovery. And the one thing that I had no success with in therapy was my weight. And she said to me, try OA. And I did. I called, and there's a meeting just a couple of blocks at a hospital, a couple of blocks away from me. And that began my recovery. I am maintaining between an 80 and 90-pound weight loss. And today I'm 5 pounds from that original weight loss. Now, when I told that to a nurse in a doctor's office, she said, isn't that great? You've maintained your weight for all of those years. She didn't realize, you know. I had, we had a death in the family. It was very unexpected in the 1990s. And I thought, what I did was, we have a friend at home, one of our fellows, who talks about eating a 90-pound ice cream cone. And a few things happened, and that's exactly what I did. I ate a 35-pound ice cream cone. And at the time, I thought it was because of the death, because of the loss. And in years to come, I mean, the death and the loss made me very vulnerable. But it wasn't the cause. There was a totally different cause. But I had no idea. I had no idea. My emotions have been hidden by anger, and it's like pulling the curtain back to really take a look at what it is that's going on. I also, about 10 years or 15 years into program, I think it was 1996, I knew that I needed to go to Al-Anon. I didn't have any idea why I needed to go to Al-Anon. My father was my qualifier. He had been dead for many, many years. And I thought, how could that possibly, his alcoholism, still possibly be affecting me? But I took, it was God, I'm sure it was God, that put the planted the seed of going to Al-Anon. And I did. And my recovery continued there. Now, when I was coming out here, I knew what I was speaking on. I spoke to a lot of my fellows, and I shared with them the topic. And I said, what do you do, you know? And interestingly, Sarah talked about surrender, and that was an answer from a lot of people, that to get down on your knees, throw your slippers and your shoes under your bed, and when you're down there on your knees looking for them, pray and really, really ask God for help. So, but one of the most interesting answers that I had, and that's really what I'd like to focus on today, is there's treasure in the trial. And I have come to understand that whatever difficulty comes up for me, there are things in it for me to learn. And I accept the difficulty as God calling me. I mean, we do know that more will be revealed. And that's what's happened to me over the course of my recovery. More has been revealed. But what was trying to be revealed to me when I had that relapse, I wasn't ready to deal with it. Within the last year, I was asked to qualify at an Al-Anon meeting, and I said that I would. And when I went to this Al-Anon meeting, it wasn't one of my regular meetings, the place was packed. They had a buffet supper. It wasn't the food that upset me. It was, it was just beautiful. I mean, the place was decorated to the hilt. They came and they gave me a corsage. I was so uncomfortable. I can't begin to tell you. And after I qualified, I really believed that I had done a lousy job. Mm-hmm. I felt the fool. You know, it's for me, it's difficult to leave myself out there. I feel raw, you know. So, of course, I had many friends there at the meeting, and they all came over to me afterwards, and they said, you were great. And I said, wasn't great. Mm-hmm. Wasn't great. You're just saying that because you're my friends. And a woman who had heard me, who was my friend, had left before the end of the meeting. And when I saw her a couple of days later, she said to me, you know, Rosemary, you were really great. And I said, they told you to say that, didn't they? I would not believe that I had offered them anything good, because that's how I felt. That's how I felt. And I really came to understand that it was that corsage. I just did not feel worthy of this. Now, I was on a retreat before I came here last weekend, and the retreat leader said that one commonality among addicts is that they don't, that is it's her experience, is that they never feel good enough. And I will tell you that in all of my relationships within program, I belong to a spiritual book club, and we're 10 women who are all in program, and that's the commonality among us. We never feel good enough. So while I was on this retreat, you know, in program it's wonderful because you come to California and I have once a year friends. You know, I'll meet people here, and if I come back next year, you know, I'll see them again and be delighted. So this retreat that I went on in January, I've been going for a couple of years, and there's one woman in particular who had qualified, and I was so moved by her qualification and spoke with her and look forward to seeing her every single year. So they have prayer partners from the retreat. And she said to me, Rosemary, what can I pray for you for today? And I told her the story about the corsage and the qualification. And I said, I never feel good enough. And so we stopped and we prayed. And she said, Dear God, thank you so much for Rosemary's willingness to give. That's so easy for her to give. Please help her feel as easy about receiving and feeling worthy. And it was such a beautiful prayer. Now, I will tell you that if this had happened earlier in my recovery, that incident, that feeling, that horrible feeling about I had nothing to offer this crowd, I did a lousy job, would have sent me right to the food. It didn't. I knew that there was something in these feelings that I needed to learn about myself, that I am good enough. And I still work hard at it, you know? I mean, it's not easy. I explained my childhood background. It was neither a Russian tragedy nor a cakewalk, somewhere in the middle. But there were a lot of things, a lot of messages that I received in childhood that I internalized. And now God is calling me to heal all of those and to know that I have worth and I have value. And now what else can I share with you? How much time do I have left?
Well, 6-7 minutes.
Okay. I want to share with you, well, that's the treasure. You know, that was the treasure in the trial for me, that awareness. And, of course, we know in program that all change begins with awareness. And, so I'm so grateful for it. I can also tell you that, well, I've shared with you that I'm an emotional eater. I can measure my emotions by my hunger. If it has been less than 3 hours since I've last eaten, I have to ask myself, what's going on? Because you shouldn't be hungry. And I numbed my feelings for so many years with food that I don't recognize the feelings. I never experienced them before. I never allowed myself to experience them because they were too painful. But, you know, today, by the grace of God and the gift of this program, I can look at them. And I really believe that that's what's meant when it says more will be revealed. I'm evolving. And I'm so happy that I didn't give up, too, when I gained that 35 pounds. I kept a sponsor. I continued to go to meetings. In terms of what, these are some of the answers that I got when I asked my fellows about what would you do, you know, to find power in relapse. Because, boy, I'll tell you, it's terrible. I mean, my experience with relapse is just awful. But I continued to go to meetings. I continued to have a sponsor. I continued with everything. I was in a bit of denial. But, you know, perhaps I just didn't have what I needed at that point to be able to take a look at it. But I trust in God that he'll always reveal more to me. Surrender was also, it was a very big answer from my fellows, that it is in surrender that we really, you know, it's that first step that allows us to come back. Acceptance is another one. And for me, if there's something troubling me, it's usually because I'm not accepting something. I had a friend who disappointed me, and I became very jealous because it seemed to be so easy for her to help another friend with a similar situation. And when I was on retreat, my retreat roommate said to me, Rosemary, have you ever thought about saying, I forgive Carol for not being the friend that I want her to be. And I forgive myself for not being the friend that she wants. And that was, I mean, that was like, it was such a revelation for me to simply forgive her for not being who I wanted her to be. So that's acceptance and prayer. I just totally believe that prayer is so important. That 11th step is so important to us. And forgiveness. And another very, very, that probably the most important is act as if. Act as if you are living the program, you know, just do it. Because, you know, they say all of the cliches are true. We can't think our way back from relapse. We need to act our way through relapse. And in my program, I tell you, I do everything that I possibly can to live this program. Somebody had invited me to hear a well-known rabbi from a 12-step program. He was speaking in a synagogue. And when we got there, one of my fellows was doing the registration. She said to me, "Oh, Rosemary, I didn't know you were Jewish." I said, "I'm not." But this man has the most marvelous message about recovery. So why would I, you know, I'm thrilled to be able to go and hear him. And most of all, there's a lot of most of alls in my qualification. My recovery is dependent upon my relationship with God. And the retreat leader that we had last weekend, she said that. She said, if you are having trouble with any aspect of your program, go to your spiritual life, because that's where it is. And for me, that's true. If I'm not accepting something, you know, that's my spiritual life that's not right, you know? If I'm not forgiving someone, that's my spiritual life that's not right. Tremendous help is the fourth step. And boy, did I tell you, I resisted doing a fourth step for many, many years. I said, I did a fourth step in therapy with my therapist. I don't need to. Well, I robbed myself of so much recovery and so much peace. Because when I'm able to fill in that fourth column, what's my part in it, it changes my perspective totally. I can then see things differently. And that's the miracle for me. That's the miracle, being able to see it. And talking about it, I think that, you know, my pride gets in the way. You know, if I'm having trouble, the last thing in the world that I want to do is go to a meeting and admit to my fellows, you know, I've eaten, I've done this, I've done that, or whatever. But it's through the humility that I'm able to find God. So I think that's about all that I have to share with you guys today. I'm so grateful to be here. And I have a wonderful life today. An absolutely wonderful. I mean, I am so blessed. And I am so grateful. And that's, for me, if I'm living in gratitude, my spiritual life is okay. I'm good. So thank you all very much.
Thank you, Rosemary. And it is now time for questions. And having gone through the ones that got thrown into the basket, probably the most popular one is, could each speaker please share what is their daily spiritual practice?
I can, if you don't want to. All right. Before I put my... Oh, sorry. Okay. I hope I can get it all in 2 minutes.
When I open my eyes in the morning, I say, thank you, God, for the gift of this day. I swim, and while I'm swimming, I pray. I say probably 2 rosaries while I'm swimming. I swim for an hour. I also speak. I am sponsored, and I sponsor. With my sponsees, we do a daily reading, a meditation, and then I also have that little 12-step prayer book, and we do pick a prayer, and they give me a number from 1 to 183, and somehow whatever number they pick seems to be appropriate to whatever's going on in their life on that day. I attend meetings. I attend meetings for both Al-Anon and OA. I mentioned that I have a spiritual book club with 10 other program women, which is great. And I do service. I do service, which is so important. And a lot of prayer. I think that's it. Thanks.
So daily spiritual practice for me is when I wake up, I slink to the floor and I say the first 3 steps. I admit that I'm powerless over food from the moment I wake up. And I've heard that we go to bed a recovered person and we wake up an addict. Mm-hmm. And so when I wake up in the morning, I have these great ideas about food and life. And then the other thing that I do, which I find part of my spiritual practice, is that I commit my food before I eat it. And I know that doesn't sound very spiritual, but I find God in that, you know, that turning it over. And generally, I email it to my sponsor the night before. A lot of days, it's the morning of. And then she and I talk every morning at 6:15 for 15 minutes. And God speaks through her to me. So that's part of my spiritual practice. Thank you.
Thank you. I've heard there's ritual and spiritual, although I don't have a really set in stone spiritual practice, daily spiritual practice. I get up and I connect with my higher power, either through usually just saying the Serenity Prayer or just saying, "Good morning, God." And as I go through my day, it says when, I'd love on awakening, and I kind of think about that through the day. In the big book, what is that, 86 and 87? Mm-hmm. One of the things, before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, asking that it be free from bad stuff. And and then the next sentence, this has been blowing my mind recently, having done so, we can use our mental faculties. We can employ our mental faculties with assurance. And I never really heard that before. It's like, okay, if I ask God to direct my thinking, I can trust. I never thought I was trustworthy before. I thought I needed to be policed. My sponsor taught me to think about where my feet are when I start to get agitated. Just remember where my feet are, that I'm in this moment. And one thing I know, when the one thing I can do, like an action I can take that is totally on me, is I can work the steps. And so last night I got some news that was really scary and I was really agitated, and I wanted to be on my phone, like asking questions and doing stuff. So I put my phone in my makeshift God box that we made out of one of the little drawers, those little pull-out drawers in the room, and pulled out my step work and started working on my steps. And it's like, when in doubt, work the steps. And having just finished a formal 10th step, like working the 10th step, my sponsor had me go through all the ones that are outlined in the literature. And so I usually do some form of that at night, depending on how the day went. Thank you.
And we had a question specifically for Rosemary, and I'll just read it off. It says, "I am also in a few 12-step programs and think the credits do not transfer, but that the study habits help. Could you share your thoughts?"
I was told early on that I have to practice each program in its own room, and I do believe that. So I attend Al-Anon meetings. I sponsor in Al-Anon. I am sponsored in Al-Anon, and I do the same thing with OA. I truly believe that all of my issues, my core are my Al-Anon issues, and that's what sends me to the food, is my relationships. And, I've also done a lot of reading about ACOA, the adult child of the alcoholic, and in the front of that book, it's like their version of the big book, and they list 14 characteristics of the adult child, and I have every single characteristic. And I attend a double winners meeting once a week, and that is for the core. The core that we all have is Al-Anon, but we also have another addiction, and that is just such a tremendous gift. You know, when I first began reading the big book, I just saw myself as everybody in the story. I was the addict, I was the victim, which was tough. Let's see. I do read Al-Anon literature. I brought Language of Letting Go with me to the convention. And OA, you know, Voices of Recovery. You know, I just work both programs. And they are, I mean, for me, they are integrated. But I do understand what the question is, that they do need, they each need their own recovery. And by the grace of God, I've been given recovery in both. So, thanks.
And a direct question for Kate R. Please share the difference between acting as if I were my higher power and acting to see it is my higher power.
To see if it is my higher power?
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah, right. Acting to see if it is my higher power, which I don't know if that's like a slogan, but I've never heard that distinction before. I love it. And that's, acting as if, particularly in my young first abstinence, was willing my way through, and it's like, no matter what, I'm going to be serene. today, acting as if... I love that. There is a curiosity to it. Like, I'm going to try this and see if it's a fit, you know? And if it feels like I can tell, God gives me that intuitive thought. Gives us all that intuitive thought. Like, when it's like, oh, yeah, that's right, you know? And I start to feel that quieter voice in my core that... you know, that usually, if the voice is, like, mean or punitive, that's not my higher power voice. Like, get out of bed! That's not higher power voice, you know? which I have that voice all the time. So, but I love that, like, let's just see. One of my favorites is act as if I'm in the body that I love today. So if I had the body I love today, what would that woman be? You know, how would she dress? How would she interact with the world? How would she eat? Would she look people in the eye? Would she listen, or would she, you know, like, would she let people merge in front of her? Would she, it's just like, how would I be if I really accepted my body today? And then it's like, well, okay, I can put on a pretty outfit. And so there's some acting as if I love my body today. And lo and behold, it was taking those kinds of actions that changed my body. So, thank you.
And a question for Sarah P. What are you the most grateful for in your recovery?
So, I'm going to say that I'm most grateful for the relationship with my sponsor. Not because she's in the room, but because for a year and a half, she hasn't gone anywhere. She hasn't left me. And the consistency of that, for someone who's an addict, consistency is an issue. Especially with people, they tend to disappear. And to have a woman pick up the phone every day, Monday through Friday, it's really a big lesson. And so there's this trust that builds with a sponsor. She has been the voice of reason when there seems to be no reason. Mm. She has taught me to go shopping for clothes that appropriately fit my body, to... build a resume, to reach out to newcomers, to stop whining about myself so much. You know, there's this, she just keeps telling me that food is not your problem, Sarah, it's life.
And then she gives me solutions for that. So I'm most grateful for my relationship with my sponsor, and then in turn with her sponsor, because it's a family. You know, there's some lineage and heritage, and it's really been a beautiful. I got really, really lucky to be roped in with the right people, and I was scared. Scared of her when I first saw her, because when I first called her on the phone to ask her if she was available, I didn't know who she was. It was somebody else had said, hey, look, I have a really great sponsor, you should call her. And so that for me was God acting through somebody else. And so I called her, and I'll wrap it up. I saw her at a meeting, and I was scared of her, and she loved me even though I was scared of her. So thank you.
And this is for everyone in the panel, if you all want to take a swing at it. What advice would you give to someone in relapse who wants to give up because they think the program won't work for them?
Please don't give up. Because if you're not, you know, if you're having trouble getting it, if you leave the rooms, you're never going to get it, you know. When I gained that 35 pounds, I never quit going to the rooms. I mean, I was in some denial. It wasn't the best place, you know, but I never stopped going. And, you know, just trust that it will happen, you know, and I think share about it. Let people know. I think everything for me is so much better once I let it out. You know, once it's out there in the open, the air seems to dilute the, you know, the power of it for me. So that would be what I would say.
So I just want to say that it's really lonely out there without program. When I was eating and I was sitting in front of the TV, it was me, it was Netflix, and it was my refrigerator. And that was the Bermuda Triangle of being out there. And as much as I hated the rooms, I don't think I would have put on the full 125 if I had stayed in the rooms. I mean, I think I probably could have curtailed it a bit. But I was out there eating on my own. So I just implore people not to leave the rooms. That's it.
I don't think there was anything anyone could have said to me when I was in relapse. But like Roberta said, there is treasure in the trial. My recovery today would not be what it is if I hadn't had my relapse. And I don't mean like, let's all go out and relapse and we can have better recovery. But it's definitely... What would I say to somebody? I remember in my first abstinence, because I had no experience with relapse, I judged anybody who was having problems. And I just thought, like, well, just work the steps harder. Or, you know, and so I'm really hesitant to say that to anyone who's struggling. Just work the steps harder. You know, you should go to more meetings. Or that'll do it. It's up to God. But and I remember there was a woman in my outside life who had gotten so skinny. And I called this anorexic woman I knew in program who had so many years of recovery, and I called her fully expecting her to tell me exactly what I should say to get this woman to start eating again. And I'm sorry, this is dark, but she's like, sometimes we just have to let them die. We have to watch them die. It's not up to us to save other people. That said, I share my experience, strength, and hope. I'm a better woman having come back from relapse. If you had told me 2 months before I entered that room, I would have just been, fuck you. No, so I'm sorry. Was that bad? what the heck do you know? Oh, I'm blushing. I think that I'm on this path. I think there's purpose in my path. And if I had maybe white-knuckled it and never left the rooms, maybe, you know, things would be different and they'd probably also be good. But I'm really grateful for the path as it's been for me.
And I'm going to ask Sarah to be the first one up, since she selected this question. How do you deal with difficulties in a relationship, be it significant other, family, friends, and coworkers?
So, without the food, without the cushion of the food, other people really bug me. I'm not as warm and fuzzy. Well, I was never warm and fuzzy, but okay. So anyway, I have difficulties with people, and it says friends and coworkers, but I'm gonna say neighbors are a bigger problem for me. And I don't know how many times I've called my my sponsor and said, my neighbors are driving me crazy, I want to kill them. You know, I want to. I was in front of the local fire department, because I was going to go in and tell the fire chief that my neighbors had a grill on their porch. And I called my sponsor, and she said, why don't you go home and write about it? You don't need to be the fire marshal. You don't need to run in there and get them in trouble for having a grill. So the way I deal with my relationships with other people is I don't act on this weird stuff that I'm going to do before writing about it, calling my sponsor, and running it through a fellow. My best decisions got me in really bad places. And going up to the fire chief, newly abstinent, and telling them that my neighbors had a grill was a really bad idea. I don't know what I was thinking, but I thought at the time it was a great idea, but my best idea. So, thank you.
Yeah, without the comfort of the food, people can be really, really challenging. 10 steps. I had a really challenging holiday this last December. I went up to visit my family and ended up, like, holding my entire family hostage with my feelings for an hour. Being in recovery doesn't promise that I'm going to love everybody and that I'm going to be the perfect daughter, perfect sister, perfect niece, perfect girlfriend. Unfortunately, I would really love for it to mean that. So the difference is I can make amends and living amends. And again, going from the, I don't know, I've let myself off the hook a little. I'm responsible for my actions, and I want to be the best woman God can have me be. And sometimes I mess up. That's hard. In my relationship, you know, there's something in the family afterward that's like, oh, this has gotten tense. Let's back away from this right now. And I forgot about that while I was, you know, crying and sobbing and yelling at my uncle. I forgot about that. And, yeah, that's my truth for today. No, I didn't binge about over it. I guess that's recovery. And whenever something like that happens, it does bring me closer to my higher power. Because I don't want to be that kind of force in the universe. So it's like another opportunity. Right now I'm in the middle of, like, somewhere between 7 and 8 on it. Kind of humbly asking God to remove my shortcomings and sort of maybe becoming willing to make amends. Sort of. So I'll keep you posted.
One of my fellows told me that relationships are the SATs of recovery. And for me, that really, you know, that's where I've been led to. I was very angry at my parents. My parents are gone for a very long time. And quite by accident, and I'm sure it was God leading me there, I began doing genealogy. And I came to understand how difficult their lives were.
So what I ended up with was just tremendous compassion for who they were, mm-hmm. and an understanding that they truly did the best that they could do. And just as I don't want to be held accountable for what I'm not able to do, it's not fair. So, you know, I've forgiven them. And, you know, there was somebody, a singer, who I'm sure is in program. She did an interview, and she said, I forgive my parents for, now, I forgive my mom. I forgive my mom for everything, and I blame her for nothing. And that's pretty much how I feel about my mom and my dad. The two most important relationships in my life are my brother and my son and his family. And as I've recovered in Al-Anon, a lot of issues have come up. One of the traits of the adult child is that they have a tendency to put people on a pedestal or look down on them. And I had placed my brother on such, and his wife, on such a pedestal. And now I've come to understand that, you know, they're human. They don't belong there. But it has been wrought with a lot of difficulty. I truly want to love them. I just want to love them. I want to forgive them for not being the brother that I wanted him to be. He came out of the same crazy family that I came out of, and he has not had recovery in a 12-step program or therapy. My son, I'm working on, you know, letting him go. You know, he's married, he has his own family, and not to be so dependent. I'm in therapy, and my therapist is tremendously helpful. I mean, I don't know how people get through life without therapy. I really don't. And I'm so grateful that I don't have to get through life without it. And relying on the steps and my fellows. So that's it.
All right, we have 3 minutes left. So one last question. How do I get beyond the shame of my past and move towards forgiveness?
Four step. It screams four step. Shame. I'm in the middle of a four step right now, and every name that goes down and every act that is written through this pen, it relieves some of that shame and pain to help me walk a little straighter, hopefully.
Thank you.
Let it out. Fourth step, great idea. Let it out. You know, I've been blessed with a sponsor that I can say just about anything to. You know, and her response is always loving and kind. And that was not part of my reality, but it is today. And that relationship has demonstrated to me that I can be loved even though there's something that I feel shameful about. But definitely, fourth step, absolutely. And the same thing, if you're in relapse, go to a meeting and talk about it. And if you can't talk about it at a meeting, pull somebody aside and talk about it. Because for me, it's letting it out. And that really helps tremendously.
A second? Yeah. I talk to myself like a cherished pet, in addition to fourth step. I do fourth step also. And sharing at meetings, definitely sharing with sponsor. But cultivating compassion for myself has given me compassion for others. Cultivating compassion for other people has given me compassion for myself. And, you know, I think about how I treat my sweet little cats. And, like, Misha, my one cat, like, he pukes on the carpet. And often. And it's just like, oh, sweetheart, you know, it's rather than be like, how could you do that? You know, it's like, you clean it up and you want to make sure he feels okay. And, like, if I could just treat myself with that same amount of compassion, so often I'll just be like, yeah, sweetheart. You're doing great. Yeah, that was really hard. There were a lot of triggers there. You did, yeah. You're doing the best you can, and not like you know, giving myself a free pass to be an asshole, but having a little bit of understanding that I'm human, I'm not God. This program brings me closer to God, but I am not God. Thank you.
All right. That is all the time we have for questions. Please help me to thank our speakers, Sarah P., Kate R., and Rosemary, for sharing their experience, strength, and hope with us today. After a moment of silence, please stand where you are and join hands as we say the Serenity Prayer.
Change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.